Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the White House meeting today between Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama that was the first since the signing of the Iran nuclear deal that Netanyahu aggressively opposed, which Obama considers one of his greatest diplomatic achievements. Kate Gould, the legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss the increase from $3.1 billion a year in U.S. military aid to $5 billion that Israel is asking for and efforts to repair the strained relations between the two leaders. Then we'll examine the killing of two American police trainers and the wounding of two others today in Jordan at the King Abdullah Special Operations Training Center, which came on the 10th anniversary of terrorist bombings at three Jordanian hotels, which left 60 people dead. The author of Inter-Arab Alliances, Regime Security and Jordanian Foreign Policy, Kurt Ryan, a professor of political science at Appalachian State University, who's also a Fulbright scholar to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, joins us to discuss the enormous strains on this fragile state coping with floods of refugees and wars on its borders. Then finally, we'll analyze whether the press scrutiny of Dr. Ben Carson's many claims that are not meeting the fact-checking test will lead to more focus on issues and policies the Republican candidates are espousing, or whether blaming the press will lead to less probing questions being asked of those seeking the presidency. Matthew Sutton, the distinguished professor of history at Washington State University and author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism, joins us to discuss the religious underpinnings of Ben Carson's magical thinking. And joining us now is Kate Gould, who's the legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestinian peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gould.
Great to be back, Ian.
And I mentioned in the opening the discussions in the White House today between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama over military aid to Israel that's being increased from $3.1 billion up to at least $5 billion, which is what the Israelis are asking for. A U.S. official apparently has predicted that both sides would settle for an annual sum somewhere between $4 billion and $5 billion. Was that what the talks were mostly about?
It sounds like, unfortunately, that is the case. It was mostly about increasing U.S. military aid to Israel. Netanyahu did tell Israeli reporters that they did not discuss settlements, despite the fact that just hours before Prime Minister Netanyahu visited D.C., press reports in Israel reveal that the government had actually approved more than 2,000 new settlement units in the West Bank. But reportedly, that did not come up in the meeting at all. What did come up is this military aid request, Netanyahu coming to the U.S. asking for $50 billion over the next decade, or $5 billion a year in military aid, a staggering amount. Really, it represents almost half of the U.S. economic and military assistance to Israel. That includes both grants and loans that have been provided over the last 60 years of Israel's existence. So, it's really an enormous amount of money. And in addition to that, they reportedly also talked about a joint task force to monitor the Iran nuclear deal. So I think, this part of military aid, of course, that should be alarming to any U.S. taxpayer. I mean, we're talking about an amount of money that means that it would represent, about $600 worth of weapons per Israeli, each year over the next decade. So it's a huge amount of money. You know, already the U.S. underwrites about 20%, about a fifth of Israel's military budget. And if Netanyahu's request was granted fully, that would mean the U.S. would be responsible for funding a third of Israel's entire military budget at where it stands now.
So in terms of repairing the strained relations between these two leaders, preceding this talk, there's been quite a lot of full-page ads in the New York Times from groups tend to be on the conservative American Jewish side in calling for both leaders to sort of get over their differences for the in the best interests of Israel's future. But there was also a very disturbing development, which was that Netanyahu's new communications chief, the person he hired to be his spokesperson, on his Facebook page, said some really, despicably, aggressive comments about Obama, essentially calling him an anti-Semite, and calling Secretary of State Kerry a 12-year-old who was sort of delusional, which really was pretty extraordinary that that would be the somebody that Netanyahu would choose as his spokesperson. And I think he had to fire him, didn't he?
Right. So the Netanyahu had appointed Barat, hadn't yet approved him, he accused Obama of anti-Semitism and suggested that Kerry had the intellect of a 12-year-old. So Netanyahu has, since distanced himself from the spokesperson in some of his comments, but it is certainly, he downplayed the comments, but very, very alarming, and even more just unbelievable that reportedly that didn't come up in the meeting at all as well. So they didn't talk about settlements. They didn't talk about these outrageous comments from Barat's, and they didn't talk about really moving forward on a solution, on a two-state solution for Israel-Palestine. So it was really that the talk was mainly dominated by this talk of increasing military aid to Israel and some mention of a joint task force to monitor the Iran agreement.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate Gould, who's the legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestine peace. So is that to say then that Netanyahu has in effect won this round? There've been a whole series of spats between the White House and Netanyahu, going back some time. Netanyahu pretty much campaigned for Obama's opponent in the last election, Mitt Romney. He showed up in Washington, spoke to the Congress, made a deal with Boehner without consulting the White House, spoke against Obama's major foreign policy initiative with Iran, and that, of course, created a lot of tensions. And it seems as in this meeting, if they weren't discussing settlements, they weren't discussing the Israeli-Palestinian situation, all they were talking about was more military aid for Israel, it would seem that Netanyahu got what he wanted and Obama got nothing.
Yes, and unfortunately, it's unclear whether President Obama tried to, move the conversation in a different direction. It sounds like he didn't, and I think that shows just how little support he perceives there is in Washington for a new, for a real change on U.S. policy toward Israel-Palestine. So it's certainly it's a loss. I mean, most of all for Palestinians and Israelis, and it's a loss for Americans who want to see a different approach to the Middle East and actually want to see peace being given a chance. So I think it's really just very alarming to see that in this time of such crisis. I mean, we're seeing, some of these numbers of the death toll, of the injuries, they rival, they come close to the very beginning of the Second Intifada, and which was a time, it's interesting because the Second Intifada, in U.S. media, it's generally talked about as a time of only Palestinian violence. And of course, when, I've been in the West Bank, and Palestinians talk about it, and of course their memory is of very heavy-handed tactics from, you know, that they remember the home invasions and the house arrests and the shootings in the middle of the night. And so, I mean, it's really a time of just devastating violence for Israelis and Palestinians, and it's disheartening for sure that that was really not part of the conversation that we saw today at the White House. I think it's also at this time where, you know, it just seems like the U.S. is unwilling to really use its leverage. I mean, one bright spot is that at least we did hear that there are some plans for looking at confidence building measures, for looking at how the Obama administration's push, and particularly Secretary Kerry's push, for some progress on Area C. So for listeners who don't know, after the Oslo Accords, the West Bank was divided into these different areas, Area A, B, and C. And Area C is most of the West Bank, 60% of the West Bank. And over these years, settlements have continued to expand, largely in Area C, also in other areas, but in Area C, and we've seen the Palestinians pushed into smaller and smaller cantons, and into the cities like Ramallah and into these other urban centers, and been forced off their land, perpetuating. I mean, it seems as if Israel's long-term plan is to just push the Palestinians into these smaller and smaller urban areas and then take over most of the land of the West Bank for settlement use. And if Netanyahu wants to show that his government has a different vision, then this is obviously the time to do so. And it sounds like Kerry is particularly interested in engaging to ensure that settlements at least stop in Area C. In these villages, and many of them, I should say, I mean, are some of the most impoverished places in the occupied Palestinian territories. We're talking about very rural places. Some of them, when I went to the West Bank, I stayed in a village where a number of Palestinians still lived in caves. They had been living there for, generations, thousands of years, and they would build houses, but they aren't allowed to in Area C. They would have their houses demolished, and right now there are schools, there are hospitals, there are medical clinics, college, all these places where they're under demolition orders, where people fear day and night that bulldozers are going to flat out demolish everything, and not for any, the Israelis are not charging these people with any crimes other than being on that land.
So given that, and you lobby on the Hill, obviously, for Israel-Palestine peace, and I'm sure you're up against a situation where there's fairly, unlimited and perhaps even unqualified support for Israel on Capitol Hill. And I noticed that Netanyahu's speaking at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, but he's also, where he's going to receive an award, but he's also going to talk on Tuesday to the Liberal Center for American Progress, which, of course, backed Obama's Iran deal, and they're advocates for a two-state solution. And the fact that Obama pretty much got nothing out of this talk, and Israel got up to $5 billion a year in U.S. military aid, would indicate to me that maybe what Obama did get is that the Democrats can go into this election year looking as if they're just as pro-Israel as the Republicans are. Is that what this exercise is all about?
Well, no question. There's some very cynical political calculations at play, as often the case. I think that there is a growing recognition that, however quiet it is, that there is a different way to see what it means to be pro-Israel. We have seen at the same time as Netanyahu has gotten all this attention that some of the top generals in Israel, and this isn't just former Israeli security officials who've been speaking out and against more hardline policies for the last several years. This is actually many current Israeli officials who are speaking out and saying that Israeli actions are further provoking and a major factor in the Palestinian violence that we see today. So we have talked to various members of Congress who are interested in that, who are monitoring that the kind of dissent in Israel and are interested in hearing more, I'm headed to the region on this Sunday, to Jordan and Israel, the West Bank and Gaza. I'm going to meet with some Israeli officials, some of these Israeli officials who have been speaking out against the current policies as far as, you know, settlement expansion, and one in particular who actually supports the Iran nuclear deal. So there are, you know, there is some recognition in Congress that there's a different kind of discussion happening in some of the highest echelons of the Israeli security establishment. But of course, that's it's slow, and we're hearing from a number of members who are interested in having a pro-peace voice, but they say, you know, they're not hearing enough from their pro-peace constituencies. I mean, there, I should mention that three members of Congress, so Congressman Ellison, Congresswoman Dingell, and Congressman Yarmuth, who actually, Congressman Yarmuth is a Jewish member of Congress from Kentucky, Congressman Ellison is a Muslim member from Minnesota, from Minneapolis, and Debbie Dingell is from Michigan, and they're who's Catholic. So there's a they represent three faiths, and they have a letter addressed to Netanyahu and also to Abbas that calls for an end to the violence, an end to divisive rhetoric, and also lifts up the example of Israeli and Palestinian peace builders, like some of those who have been working with the Parent Circle, the group of Israelis and Palestinians who've lost a loved one to the violence and who are working for an end to the occupation. So there is that effort going on. It's actually, the letter is open through November 18th, and if people are interested in having their member of Congress sign on, they can find out more about that at our website at fcnl.org. But, you know, and those kinds of efforts are so important because it is, I mean, more and more members of Congress are recognizing the real the issue here, that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories is a root cause of the violence that we're seeing. But they, in order for them to speak out, they really feel the political heat, and they need to know that there's a pro-peace constituency.
So just in the last minute or so, you're going to be meeting in Israel with senior military and intelligence officials who are still serving inside of the intelligence and military services?
We are not meeting with current Israeli security officials. We're meeting with we are meeting actually with some current Israeli political officials, and then also planning to meet with former Israeli security officials. So still working all those details out, and we can't talk too much about the details, but we're meeting also with Israeli and Palestinian peace builders. We're going to Gaza and seeing various a tour with UNRWA and the UN Relief and Works Agency, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, and we're also seeing various, you know, humanitarian projects, seeing really the devastating impact of the blockade and this, you know, nearly 2 million people that haven't been able to rebuild after so many attacks, so many bombardments of their homes and schools and hospitals. So we're going to the West Bank. We're seeing this village called Susia, and I would lift that up as an example. I mean, it is. It seems very unlikely that that village would still be standing if it weren't for congressional intervention. There have been a number of members of Congress. There have been people like Senator Feinstein, who has publicly actually wrote a letter to Netanyahu about expressing concern about the Israeli plans for demolition of Susia. And then there have been other members who've made private calls and to the Israeli embassy, to the State Department, expressing concern about this village that is, you know, under demolition orders simply for the purpose of settlement expansion. So this village has, there's been reporting about it in the New York Times. It's gotten a lot of attention because it's a small village, but the demolition would set a very disturbing precedent of the kinds of demolition on a mass scale that could really take over the West Bank and permanently end any hope, of course, of a two-state solution and really of any solution in the near term. So it's extremely important that we work to make sure that these villages can stay standing, that people can actually stay standing.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Kate Gould.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kate Gould, who's the legislative representative for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and the Israel-Palestinian peace. And we're going to take a brief station break and back examining the killings of two American police trainers and the woundings of two others today in Jordan.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kurt Ryan, who's a professor of political science at Appalachian State University, specializing in international relations and comparative politics, with particular interest in Middle East politics, Islam and politics, and international terrorism. He's also a Fulbright scholar to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, and is the author of Jordan in Transition, From Hussein to Abdullah, and Inter-Arab Alliances, Regime Security, and Jordanian Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kurt Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
And what is the significance of the fact that two American police trainers and a South African contractor, along with a Jordanian officer, were killed by a Jordanian police officer today? Obviously, we've spoken in the past about what a tinderbox, in many ways, Jordan is, with all of the wars going around its borders, a massive refugee influx, tremendous stresses and strains, not to mention a huge percentage of its population living in Palestinian camps. So how do you see this in the broader picture?
Well, I think it's going to raise all those same questions. Again, Jordan's participation in a lot of these events, and certainly in the campaign against ISIS in particular, has been fairly controversial inside the country. There are some people supportive of it, some people who think Jordan shouldn't get involved and that it may be inviting upon itself some kind of retaliation from Islamist movements. And well, we don't know yet. I mean, it's hard to say what the significance is since we don't know the motivation of the actual shooter. But I do know that a lot of people are quite worried about the timing of it in particular, since this is the anniversary, the 10th anniversary precisely, of the worst terror attack in Jordanian history, which was the Al-Qaeda in Iraq bombed three different hotels in the Jordanian capital, Amman, killed almost 60 people, and that was seen as allegedly retaliation for Jordan's connection to the Iraq War, which Jordan had actually opposed. But for all Jordanians, that was a really devastating event and really traumatizing. And here we are at the 10th anniversary, and this occurs. So the question is this a one-off, completely separate incident, or is it in some way connected to that? And I don't think we know yet, but I think that's what people are very worried about.
Well, surely the Jordanian people are still trying to kind of process what happened to the Jordanian pilot that the Islamic State burned alive. I imagine that was a massive trauma for the country.
Oh, it really was. I mean, I think people who are for or against Jordan's role, and as I said, there's a lot of discussion and a lot of debate inside the country about this. It is very controversial, but it was also a rallying point. I mean, all Jordanians, I think, from every walk of life, those for the regime, those who are not big fans of the regime, were horrified at what happened there. And even before the actual event, the actual brutal murder of the pilot, even in the many days leading up to that, people were really fixated on it and captivated by it, because there was real expectation that there was going to be a negotiated release of their pilots. So the whole country had rallied around him as in effect a son of Jordan, the son of everyone. And so when it ended so horribly, tragically, and honestly in such a gruesome way, it really did traumatize the whole country. It still left us with all the debates, so I think it's changed the tone. People weren't willing to quite loudly question a lot of policies at that point. But I think we've left with the same questions ever since. Should Jordan be, did that mean, in other words, Jordan should get more involved or less involved, or which way? And we're still debating that. And I think today's incident will only add to those debates, really.
So do we know the extent to which U.S. contractors are there, given that two American contractors were killed, a South African contractor, and two more Americans were wounded, along with four Jordanians in this incident? So it sounds like, and by the way, this Jordanian police officer who killed the two Americans, the South African and the Jordanian, along with wounding two other Americans and four Jordanians, he apparently had been recently fired from the police.
Yeah, I had heard that report, but I didn't hear any indication. I guess it's so early to find out that he had been involved in, they're trying to track, was this a personal grudge and grievance? Is this a disgruntled, recently fired person, and that's the issue? Or was it politically motivated? And I guess we don't know the second part of that yet. But, yeah, the connection is actually quite extensive, that on the one hand, U.S. Jordanian security, intelligence, military cooperation is really extensive. But this particular institution, the Jordan International Police Training Center, just outside of Amman, has been around for, 12 years now. It was established after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And Jordan, as I said, has opposed the U.S. invasion, but it had also maintained its relationship with the U.S. It had warned that it would be a disaster. But it did, in effect, step up to help train people in the new Iraqi, for the new Iraqi government, specifically the police. And thousands of officers have gone through that particular program. It's now expanded, so they're also, they trained some Libyan police, some police for the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, but still mainly Iraqis. And we don't know the exact numbers, because it's the U.S. government isn't all that forthcoming about what the numbers are precisely about in any kind of security relationship. But some guesstimates are more than 1,000 U.S. contractors and trainers, not just at that facility, but at others as well.
And the facility is called the King Abdullah Special Operations Training Center, isn't it? It's near the capital of Amman.
Yeah, there are two. There are a couple nearby centers, actually. That's so it's actually even bigger than that. There's the King Abdullah Special Operations Center, and there's also a Jordan International Police Training Center. And my understanding is that this occurred exactly at that institution. So there are actually multiple different programs here. One is for training special operations military personnel. The other for police personnel. I believe this occurred, as far as I can tell, on the police campus, if you will. That actually, I'll just also underscore the point, though, that Jordan has this even other role of training. It takes great pride in the training of its own armed forces, first of all, as a small but specialized armed forces. But it's also trained the special forces of other countries, of regional allies, and has all kinds of connections to the Gulf states in particular. And for the U.S. personnel, I would say there are also U.S. personnel happen to be in the country supporting a squadron of F-16 jet fighters who do, in fact, strike ISIS, as well as a Patriot missile battery that was left there in anticipation of Bashar al-Assad potentially using chemical weapons, and now is really there, presumably, for to defend against Daesh or ISIS. So there are multiple different programs going on that have just increased the U.S. Jordanian connection, but it is politically sensitive inside the country, which is why I think both the U.S. and Jordanian governments are kind of quiet, to be honest, about how many personnel are actually there. And so it's a bit sketchy in terms of what the actual numbers are.
And again, I'm speaking with Kurt Ryan, who's a professor of political science at Appalachian State University, specializing in international relations and comparative politics, with particular interests in Middle East politics, Islam and politics, and international terrorism. He's also a Fulbright scholar to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and the author of Jordan in Transition, From Hussein to Abdullah and Inter-Arab Alliances, Regime Security and Jordanian Foreign Policy. Well, according to some reports, this actually incident did happen at the King Abdullah Special Operations Training Center.
Okay.
So we'll obviously get some more clarification on that. But just touching on King Abdullah, and you mentioned earlier that he was sort of on the outs with the Bush-Cheney administration over the invasion of Iraq, which he did not support. And he urged and warned against this invasion. And now, of course, we know that George W. Bush's own father has come forth and made some criticism of Cheney and Rumsfeld sort of essentially stealing the son's presidency out from under him. And my understanding is that Abdullah really did do all he could to get to Bush and warn him what a terrible idea the invasion of Iraq would be, and that he was kind of cut off at the pass by Cheney. Is that your understanding, that later King Abdullah simply became a person non grata in the Bush White House because he was trying to warn them against the folly of the invasion of Iraq?
Yeah, I think he maintained a fairly decent relationship with the United States, to the point of certainly not being completely cut off. But there were definitely members of the administration that were less than happy with him, Cheney in particular, because the king and his officials tried to dissuade the U.S. from this attack. But I think it's for the Jordanian side of things, I think it's important to get that they were also kind of haunted by the earlier version of this. And when the United States went after Iraq in 1991, Jordan was in a more awkward position there, because then King Hussein, King Abdullah's father, had tried to take a middle position, not backing Saddam Hussein and his invasion, but not backing this massive coalition intervening either, arguing it would destabilize the region. But unfortunately, he managed to alienate both sides, really, and was inaccurately seen as having picked a side. But the bottom line for Jordan was they were cut off briefly from American foreign aid. They were cut off from Gulf aid, again, somewhat briefly. They're cut off from their sources of oil. It was economically devastating. Then they bounced back from it. And then King Abdullah, since he's been in power since 1999, I think he was really mindful of that in the twists and turns and the forever caution that marks Jordanian foreign policy, that above all things, do not get completely cut off from one's ally, especially for an aid-dependent country like Jordan. They just can't afford to alienate the U.S., the Gulf states. So they're constantly walking this sort of tightrope between them. And I think that's what he did with President Bush. He warned, he warned, he warned, and then said, okay, if you're going to do it anyway and not take my warning, we will at least help you in the aftermath, including the training of Iraqi police for the new Iraq.
So given that there's a great deal of ambivalence in the country about the war next door in Syria and the involvement of Jordan following the burning alive of the pilot that was shot down, but also Jordan is shouldering an enormous burden with Syrian refugees in these huge camps in the middle of nowhere up on the border there between Jordan and Syria. We know that in Turkey, the Turks spent a lot of money on humanitarian aid, and they just basically, you know, essentially opened the doors to the camps and encouraged people to move to Europe. And now the Turkish leader is kind of using that leverage over the Europeans to say, you know, give us more money and we'll take care of them here so they don't go to Europe. What's happening on the Jordanian side? Are they, because, you know, you say this is a country that requires U.S. aid, but it's also a country that's providing aid, which it obviously can't afford.
Yeah, that's true. I think it would be, even if ISIS didn't exist, which is another threat to Jordan that they're really concerned about. Even if that weren't the case, they have the major refugee crisis going to the point where there are roughly 640,000 registered refugees in the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan right now. But many Jordanians, certainly the government official estimate is that it may actually be double that. It's at least several hundred thousand more of Syrians who are not registered as refugees but are, in fact, inside the country, plus maybe 300,000 Iraqi refugees still left over from the Iraq War after 2003. And it's a country that has wave after wave after wave of people who are the descendants of Palestinian refugees over the years. So it's gotten refugees from almost every direction, probably more than any other country in the world. And the current crisis is, yes, it's colossal. I mean, for a country that's not quite 7 million people, to have potentially as many as a million Syrian refugees inside the country has really been devastating. So, no, they can't afford it. And they rely on foreign aid, foreign support, which is at the moment operating at less than 30% of the actual cost. But working with the UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, lots of other NGOs on the ground, but constantly looking for countries to come up with the cash that they keep pledging to do, but they're always behind on. So it has been a real crisis, and as this has gone on, I mean, ideally they hope the refugees will go back home to a peaceful Syria someday. But the other crisis that's looming around the corner, or perhaps is already here, is if they're not going home anytime soon, Jordanians are now having to wrestle with, well, what does that mean? Do we let them work in society legally? And if we do, does that mean more and more people all over the country? Because most people are actually not in the camps, they're in the cities. What does that mean for the demographics of Jordan? What does it mean for political issues? Because these identity politics were already quite tense inside the country and difficult, and this has just added a whole other layer of crisis. So crisis economically, crisis politically, crisis socially as well.
Well, apparently that's exactly what's happening in Lebanon. The Lebanese are starting to get, very, stressed about this enormous number of refugees, I think about a quarter of their population, all looking for jobs and competing with local people for jobs because they're so desperate, the refugees, that they'll work for next to nothing. I imagine that's probably happening in Jordan, is it?
To some extent, yeah. I would say that the public perception is that there's a real danger of Syrians taking the jobs and so on, that it's really deadly for the Jordanian labor force and economy. But actually, a lot of what people would be wanting to do wouldn't actually compete with a lot of Jordanians. It just requires a certain amount of coordination. Socially, the stress level was really, really high, especially in the north, where some of the country's poorest towns and cities like Mafraq, were already in rough circumstances, were already under and unemployed, and then have this on top of it. They can't afford the refugee issue. They don't want to have labor competition. But there is a way. I think there are ways to coordinate this. The kingdom is big on a very neoliberal style of economic transition, and that has included all kinds of industrial zones and manufacturing, et cetera. But most of Jordanians actually don't do that. They're importing foreign labor, and frankly, there's one place where they wouldn't be competing with Jordanians. It would make Syrians gainfully employed. They wouldn't be competing with Jordanians, and it would be a way to ease the tensions maybe in both communities and actually boost the Jordanian economy, oddly enough, out of what is otherwise a crisis and disaster.
Well, just in closing, with these northern towns that you talked about, the poor northern towns in Jordan, isn't that where Zarqawi came from? And Zarqawi was really, in many ways, the founder of what became the Islamic State. And the fact that there was a policeman who was fired, who killed two Americans and a South African and Jordanian today, at least on the surface, indicates that at least there's some traction for the Islamic State itself within Jordan.
Well, yeah, Zarqawi was a Jordanian national. He was the founder of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He was the architect of the disastrous bombings exactly 10 years ago. Of course, as soon as he became Al-Qaeda and so on, he was stripped of his Jordanian citizenship, et cetera. But there have been many people in the country who joined the jihadi movements in Syria, who crossed the border to fight with him in Iraq during that conflict and the insurgency there, but then during the Syrian civil war, either joined either the Nusra Front or Daesh or ISIS as they developed. So there is a sort of Salafi jihadi community or constituency, I suppose, inside Jordan. I wouldn't say it's not particularly colossal. The older Islamist movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, outnumbers them greatly. But there is, some traction, to use your term. I think that's accurate. Not a ton, but the regime is very, very worried about it. The intelligence services have been all over it. So even the slightest hint that somebody is sympathetic, even in a Facebook post, is enough to have the authorities show up and try to intervene early. So there is no future Zarqawi, actually. But that is definitely something that they're worried about very, very much.
Well, Kurt Ryan, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Kurt Ryan, who's a professor of political science at Appalachian State University, specializing in international relations and comparative politics, with particular interests in Middle East politics, Islam and politics, and international terrorism. He's also a Fulbright scholar to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and the author of Jordan in Transition, From Hussein to Abdullah and Inter-Arab Alliances, Regime Security and Jordanian Foreign Policy. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into whether the press scrutiny of Dr. Ben Carson's many claims will lead to more focus on issues and policies or less probing questions being asked those seeking the presidency.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger, that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
Fooling on the human population. I know my mind's on the front line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matthew Avery Sutton, who is the Edward R. Meyer Distinguished Professor of History at Washington State University and the author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Sutton.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be back.
And how do you explain this apparent meltdown of Ben Carson, where so much of his narrative in his books and in his campaign, although clearly it's unusual to have a presidential candidate doing a book tour at the same time running for president, but he has sort of commingled his presidency with his profiteering as a speaker, as an author, his business manager. He doesn't have a campaign manager. He has a business manager, Armstrong Williams. So, you know, you can feel how reality is catching up to the narrative. But at the same time, I guess this is really about the world that his mind inhabits, which is essentially the world of a believer in a particular form of Christian fundamentalism. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it is. And it's part of it is also just simply that it's amateur hour, that I think his success was not something he anticipated, or I'm sure he dreamed of it, but it was not something that he had the infrastructure to deal with. And so the meltdown is, I think, a response to the growing tension. And just the fact that he's running this campaign parallel to a book tour has to indicate that he didn't actually take the campaign all that seriously. I think he suspected he would be this sort of prophetic outsider who could raise some objections, who could make some points, who could push the mainstream candidates to take his ideas more seriously. But his role has shifted, and now that he's become the leading candidate in the Republican Party, there is a lot more scrutiny, there are a lot more questions, and he's showing so far that he just wasn't prepared, he wasn't ready for those.
But what does it say about the Republican Party? Has it really been captured by a sort of, you know, that born-again constituency who clearly feel that Ben Carson is one of them?
Yeah, I wouldn't say captured, but there's no doubt, and this has been true since the mid-80s, that evangelical Christians have been the largest multi-issue advocacy group within the Republican Party. Now, there are other groups that have more power focusing on single issues, things like the NRA. But evangelicals have been central to Republican politics for 30 years now, and every time we sort of try and bury the religious right and think it's done, it comes back, and it comes back in new ways and in different ways, but it always comes back. And I think the Ben Carson campaign is an indication that as much as we may have thought with, you know, two elections of Barack Obama that religious fundamentalists were gone, but they just simply aren't. They, you know, they're regrouping, they're rethinking their strategies, there are new leaders coming into position, but ultimately these folks who focus on a particular religious narrative and a particular set of issues still have tremendous sway in the Republican Party because they do something. They get out there. They get people registered to vote. They get people engaged. They, you know, they do all the grassroots work that's necessary for a campaign to succeed. And so Ben Carson has tapped into those people.
But what does it say about the Republican Party over the long term if recent polls indicate that now the number of true believers in this country is diminishing, and the number of the so-called nones, N-O-N-E-S, those that don't believe in religion, and that's particularly growing amongst the millennials, is growing considerably. So there's so in other words, the aging white Christians dying off, and the young people are not joining the ranks of the evangelicals in any numbers. In fact, they're joining the ranks of the agnostics, if not the atheists.
Yeah, my sense of those numbers was that evangelicals at the moment were not growing, but they were holding relatively steady, that a lot of those nones are coming out of more liberal Protestant traditions. But regardless, yeah, it's bad news for the Republican Party. And I, you know, I'm not privy to the backroom discussions in the GOP, but my sense is between Donald Trump and Ben Carson, they must just be, you know, pulling out their hair. This is a disaster for them. And in many ways, you know, Trump is going the wrong direction and trying to create a more inclusive, a more racially inclusive or gender inclusive big tent. And then we've got Carson, who's just galvanizing this religious ideology all over again. And so for all of the work that Republican moderates have tried to do to get away from those kinds of folks, this primary campaign is just absolutely the opposite. So they must just be horrified and continuing, I'm sure, to hope and pray for a more established, more moderate candidate to eventually move to the lead.
But how can the same religious conservatives, the religious right, as it's loosely called, be both supporting Trump and Carson? They're not mutually exclusive. A lot of conservative Christians also support Trump, even though he's a sort of New Yorker and was on Saturday Night Live. He obviously didn't do the sketches that he thought were too risque. But in general, it's pretty hard. I mean, he can't even really tell you about the churches and stuff of the Bible. I mean, he tries to show that he was a good Presbyterian but the only church he ever went to is Norman Vincent Peale's sort of motivational church in New York. So I'm not sure that what kind of a, I mean, there's no question about Carson's Christian fundamentalist credentials, but Trump's are pretty thin.
No, I agree. And I think Trump's appeal initially among evangelicals was for people who partly were pragmatic. And this was the same deal they made in 1988 when, you know, they were split between Pat Robertson and George Herbert Walker Bush, which was, do we go with the candidate we think can win, or do we go with the guy who best represents our values? And many of them ultimately rejected the guy who represented their values, Pat Robertson, and lined up behind George Herbert Walker Bush. And I see a little bit of a devil's compromise again for those who are still supporting Trump. But the larger issue, I think, is there's been a shift, and that was when a series of evangelical leaders came out and denounced Trump and put their support behind Ben Carson. I think a lot of people in the pews recognized that actually there was a viable alternative to Donald Trump, and that viable alternative was Ben Carson. And I continue to be fascinated that it's Ben Carson at all and not Marco Rubio or Cruz, but nevertheless, for the moment, they seem to be moving away from Trump and to Carson.
And again, I'm speaking with Matthew Avery Sutton, who's the Edward R. Meyer Distinguished Professor of History at Washington State University and the author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. So in terms of all of this fact-checking that's going on with Carson's claims, both in his books and on the stump, almost all of which are falling apart quite rapidly. And of course, he's mad at the press and blaming the press, and his constituency honestly believe that the liberal press exists, which I find extraordinary. being on with the Pacifica Foundation Press, which is as far as left you have in the American media, and they're going bankrupt. So nobody could tell me right. that there's a powerful left-wing media in this country. It's absolutely, you know, on its last legs. So that whole canard is a comfortable one, but a very specious one to begin with, if there's such a thing as a liberal press. But people really believe that. So you're left with a question as to whether he is either, you know, Carson's certainly not a saint, but is he a liar or is he just inhabiting a magical world?
Yeah, I would say it's. I don't think he's intentionally a liar, and I could be proven wrong down the road. But I think the key here is that the narrative he shaped is a conversion narrative, and that was the point of writing it in his early book, was to tell the story of going from darkness into light. And this is the classic biblical tale of how Saul becomes the Apostle Paul when he's blinded. He can't see anything, and then suddenly he gets the light, and he sees Jesus, and this becomes the story of, you know, Paul, the first apostle. So what for Ben Carson, he did what many evangelicals have done for generations, which is to talk about his period of darkness, his period of sin, his period without Jesus, and all the dark and damaging and damning kinds of things he did. And at that point, possibly he exaggerated him. He certainly would not be the first evangelical to have exaggerated his bad boy days. But then we have that moment of redemption, that flip. And so for his hearers, for his followers, that's the key, is going to be the conversion. It's that whatever he was before he met Jesus Christ, he is somebody new. He's a new man. He's a new creation. And so they're not going to obsess over those details. And they're all going to recognize that we're all sinners, that they're all sinners, that Ben Carson was a sinner. And so whether or not the story was exaggerated is just not a concern to them. And furthermore, until somebody can prove that it was exaggerated, I think he can play up on this liberal media thing and asking why the media hasn't, you know, gone into Barack Obama like they have into him. Because until the media produces any counter evidence, at this point it's just asking questions. And so for Carson, he can play the persecuted victim. He can play, you know, the victim of the vast left-wing conspiracy. And so that actually works. So this story, as long as he handles it appropriately, this story can actually help him with the public, at least with his voters, and not hurt him.
So, you know, the other candidate, of course, on the Republican side that people are digging into his past is Marco Rubio. And he is, of course, using the same technique of blaming it on the media rather than addressing some of the questions about his past and particularly his financial dealings. I mean, there's an extraordinary story in Politico, which I did an interview with the author on the other day. Rubio's sister, oldest sister, is married to the chief lieutenant of the character that Al Pacino played in the movie Scarface, this Cuban massive drug kingpin in Miami who went to jail along with Marco Rubio's brother-in-law, given long sentences. They squealed and got out in 12 years. He stashed away $25 million. It's still somewhere out there and is very much a part of the Rubio family. That in itself is not necessarily a criticism of Rubio, but the fact that the files were purged of any mention of how what letters were written on his behalf to get him out of jail, et cetera, they were all taken from. So there are certainly some questions out there about Rubio's past, but he's much more secular, but very much, I think, much cleverer in his sort of rapid response, blame it on the media. Team Rubio seems to be quick off the mark. I get the impression that Carson is just twisting in the wind at his recent press conference trying to defend himself. He just came out with a bunch of crazy conspiracy theories about Barack Obama rather than answer the question. So it seems to me that there's a similarity between both candidates, but Rubio is able to handle it so much better than Carson.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I suspect that comes with the fact that Rubio has done serious campaigning in the past and has, you know, has a better political team advising him, and he's probably doing a better job of listening to that political team. And so he's going to handle these kinds of questions better. And certainly, you know, all the candidates are going to be scrutinized. Certainly Hillary Clinton has had her share of people looking into the skeletons in her closet, and it will continue and continue and continue. So it's a little disingenuous for any of these guys to claim that that's not part of a legitimate presidential campaign or part of the legitimate role of journalists. But nevertheless, it's the response and is the key, and you're exactly right, that Rubio has been much more careful about how he's responded and has been more conscious of what he needs to tap into and what he doesn't in doing that. And Carson has not. I think Carson just seems to have thought he was above question. He was above having to respond to these kinds of things, and he's quickly realizing that that's not the case.
Well, I think that the way that one can look at these grueling presidential marathons that go on for years is that they certainly are a kind of crucible that tests these candidates for better or for worse. I mean, as much as I think most of what's going on in the discourse is trivial and you know, a lot of it doesn't rise above TMZ and you know, the Kardashians in its kind of focus. But on the other hand, if you survive, you know, and many people crashed and burned, Howard Dean, one scream and he's gone, you know, Ed Muskie breaking into tears, he's gone. There's a certain amount of discipline required to go through these grueling marathons. And that in itself, I think, you know, people should, rather than get so defensive about the terrible press asking terrible questions, should, I think, surely recognize that this is a part of the process. And at the end of the day, you want somebody that can survive all this and come out the other side still standing.
Oh, they should. And I wish they did. And I would think that they would also welcome hard questions, because hard questions in terms of policies would also give them a chance to test out their ideas, to try out their ideas, to recognize, you know, their own limitations, to have some criticism from people who know a lot. But obviously that's not the way it's come, where everything is down to the soundbite and kind of each media is assumed to have an agenda, each media group, each journalist. And so they play into this opposite narrative, which is not, let me explain the questions in full, but instead it's, what are you really after? What's really behind that question, and how are you trying to take me down? And it's unfortunate, I think, for the public, because we don't get good discussions and we don't get good answers to our questions. But it seems to have been effective in recent years, and this is back to Carson's evangelical Christianity. It's particularly effective among a group that thinks it's having its rights violated at this moment. That is, they see issues over abortion, especially issues over gay marriage, as they see what they think is the government's indifference to Christian rights abroad. All these things foster their kind of persecution, their martyr complex. And so Carson becomes one more victim in that long line of the saints who have sort of crucified themselves for the cause of Christ.
So is it possible then that this whole sort of ginned up scandal over the persecution of Carson, because I get much more solicitations from right-wing media groups offering me interviews, and there's so many people talking about the hideous martyrdom of Dr. Ben Carson by these jackals in the liberal press, that it's clearly, you know, sort of fervent narrative out there. But on the other side, as you just pointed out, in these recent debates, in terms of their policy answers, they've made some outrageous remarks, many of which were just barefaced lies. Trump denying something that was on the front page of his own website. I mean, it's, you know, you just, are they really throwing up this smokescreen of the unfair media in order not to be asked tough questions and real follow-up questions on policy as opposed to personality?
You know, it's hard for me to know what's going on in their minds. I do think that they actually believe this stuff, and I think there is some evidence. I mean, the Carson story is a classic example. The story ran, so CNN went out and interviewed people who did not remember what Carson remembered. They didn't say what Carson said wasn't true. They just said, that's not the guy that I know. And then it turned into this story about, is Carson lying? Well, again, you can't prove a negative. That they don't remember what didn't happen is not a story. And so I can understand why Carson was frustrated, but then the problem was then his response. That instead of just kind of laughing it off and saying, this is sloppy journalism, he got defensive and made it the left-wing conspiracy, and then that fuels the anger of the right, and so then there's all these other stories. So he really turned this into a far bigger story than it had to be. But I think it is because he really believes that he's being asked questions that aren't fair, and that's unfortunate. I think our politicians should get a little tougher and should be less afraid of being asked hard questions.
Well, Matthew Sutton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. I love being on.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Avery Sutton, who's the Edward R. Meyer Distinguished Professor of History at Washington State University and the author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.